ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Robin Williams here. I've been bringing you The Science Show for 50 years, somehow.
And I'm Belinda Smith, the host of Lab Notes, the brand new sister show that gives you the latest discoveries in under 15 minutes.
Between us, we love all of science, old and new.
So whether you've got an hour or just a quarter of one,
we've got science covered. To hear us, search for The Science Show,
where you'll find both Lab Notes and Science Show. Go check it out.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. What does visiting a national park mean to you? Soaking up that sweet clean air and shimmering green foliage, maybe if you're extra lucky, rolling out a swag for a night or two, being careful to tread lightly, take nothing but memories, leave nothing but footprints. Or maybe the idea of self-supported camping in the bush is a bit daunting to you. So how do you feel about the idea of businesses providing glamping in our national parks? Is it a way of helping people who aren't super intrepid to enjoy nature? Or pricing people out, making our parks even less accessible? Also ahead, with the ability to use AI to resurrect the dead, are we making it harder for them to rest in peace? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, the Bureau of Meteorology has revamped its website, and to say that people have strong opinions about it is an understatement. Whether you like or loathe it, the flood of your reactions has shown me one thing. You love weather. It's about so much more than just small talk. So what is it about the weather that has us so obsessed? In a moment, you'll meet a man who's literally written a book called Weather Obsession. But first, Nate Byrne, the ABC's very own meteorologist. You've probably seen him on ABC News Breakfast. He was literally there 3 minutes ago. Nate, thank you for running into the studio to talk to me about the weather.
Oh, take it. You know, I would run anywhere to come have a chat with you, especially if it's to do with the weather. You know that.
What is it about this website redesign that is getting so much attention?
Well, who hasn't looked at the Bureau of Meteorology website at some point, right? It's the most popular government website there is, and by a long way. I mean, it's not very often that people wake up in the morning and go to something.gov.au other than the Bureau of Meteorology, because you need to figure out what it is you're going to wear. You know, weather's one of those things that really matters to people in a practical way every single day. And when the way that you get the information and the actual information that's available to you changes, I understand why people get a bit upset. I mean, for me, it's caused me an absolute nightmare. I'm having trouble finding half of the stuff that I usually use to do my job every day. But, you know, we're persevering.
I mean, it's literally your job. Not everyone gets to be a meteorologist, unfortunately. Where did your own interest in weather begin?
I think for me, it was as a kid. The meteorology and the being a television weather presenter, two very separate things. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be a TV weather presenter because I thought they only had to do 5 minutes work a day at the end of the news. Know. I thought that meant more time to play. I was very wrong. But the weather side of things, I think, yeah, as a kid, grew up in WA, my parents used to take us down to the local boat harbour when there was a frontal system coming in, and we'd watch the lightning, you know, coming in over the Indian Ocean, and then try and run from, it's probably very dangerous, you know, it was the 80s, so different standards now perhaps, but we'd run from the edge of the water back to the car and try to beat the rain. You know, it was one of the things I'd love doing, especially in summer, and used to do it pretty regularly. And I think that started to get me interested in what's going on. And, you know, the weather's this huge, massive sort of problem that needs to be solved every day to try to predict the future. And I just find that such an interesting challenge that I get to do every single day.
Yeah, the forecasting part is really interesting. Forecasters do get it wrong from time to time. They're pretty good, and they're better now than they used to be. Yeah. People love to point out when they do. How do you respond to those sorts of criticisms?
You try predicting the future. I mean, come on. I get it. The problem with forecasting is that people want to know exactly what's going to happen. And unfortunately, that's literally not possible to nail perfectly every single time. We get pretty darn close, pretty darn often, which is amazing. You know, and we can give you a good idea about what's going to happen, not only over the next 24 hours, but out potentially as far as 7 days. Oh, by the way, anyone telling you anything beyond 7 days? It's rubbish. Oh. Don't think about it. Yep. Not worth your time. There is far too much chaos in the system, and little tiny errors at the start grow really, really big, really, really quickly. So beyond 7 days, it's not worth thinking about. When there is criticism, it's often because the type of weather information that you've received hasn't really demonstrated the error bars, the left and right of arc of what's really going on. You know, when you see a forecast for a capital city that says a shower or two, the number of times people have had written to me or had a go at me and said, hey, mate, look up, it's clear blue skies. And I have to say, yes, but it's also 11 o'clock in the morning. There's a heck of a lot more of the day to come, you know. Whereas if you dig into the forecast a little bit more and get it a little bit more information, then often it turns out they weren't wrong. They just maybe you didn't get the full story about what was going to happen over any 24-hour period.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Nate Byrne, our meteorologist here at the ABC, about weather obsession, really, off the back of the bomb website redesign and the strong opinions that you have had about it. You are already sending me so many emails, texts. But I do want to read this one out from Rose, who says, one hot summer evening a few years ago, I checked the bomb for updates. The summary, an oppressive night, was so poetically astute that I sent a message to the widget on the site. Rose says, to my surprise and delight, someone, an actual real person, replied. And we had a brief discussion about language, meteorology, and the power of metaphor. Well, that's a positive story about the Bureau.
Do you know, that is one of my favourites, Tegan. It sits right next to the other one that is often comes at the same time as an oppressive night, and it's a sultry night.
Ooh,
that's an official, it's an official forecast term, and I love it so much. But, you know, that's because forecast, the science of weather came long after we knew about weather and talking about weather. So we've got all of these sort of common phrases that have moved into the science, you know, rather than having scientific phrases that then go out into the public realm. So, you know, we get things like a fine forecast, which sounds kind of dull, but it means it's a beautiful day. No rain is actually all it means. Language in the weather is always very interesting, I think.
That thing about language in the weather is so interesting and kind of the perfect segue to bring in Laurie Zion, who's also with us today. Laurie is a professor of journalism at La Trobe University and the author of a book titled The Weather Obsession. Laurie, welcome to Life Matters.
G'day, Tegan, and hi, Nate.
Laurie, it's been far too long, my friend. How are you?
Good. But can I jump in on just something you said, and that is the term fine. Isn't that, Nate, one of the terms that got kind of taken out of the lexicon for forecasts because people didn't understand what a lot of people were.
It's still acceptable to be used, but we try to be a little clearer because that's so emotionally laden for people.
Laurie, I did want to pick up on this as well, because part of what you've found in a lot of weather obsession and researching your book that came out a couple of years ago was how much more weather literate we are now. Nate was saying that we have a lot of words from our casual lexicon that have entered the weather vocabulary, but it has started to come the other way as well.
Yeah, great point, Tegan. Actually, it was about 8 or 9 years ago I wrote the book, and what I observed there was this massive change in the 21st century in the way that people access weather. First of all, you've got all these sort of passive ways of doing it. If your phone shows you a temperature when you pick it up, it may not be sourced by the Bureau of Meteorology, maybe it is. But then I think severe weather and the popularity of online articles that can kind of not just tell you what happened, but can run a running commentary on a weather event. So the storms that were experienced, say, in Brisbane and in Melbourne last weekend, it just means that for people to be able to understand that they need to be able to understand the broader language. And then the terms that you mentioned come from the Southern Oscillation Index, which has always been a natural variable, if you like. But now I think people, if there's an El Nino that is called by the Bureau for the upcoming summer, which happened a couple of years ago, it becomes a real event in its own right. And what's really interesting about that is media outlets then run a whole lot of explainers, and it's incredible now how those terms have become part of the sort of everyday language when talking about what's happening with the weather.
Yeah, people just have this vocabulary and knowledge that I just didn't have it before. Yeah. On the text line, Andrew says, I'm a farm contractor. The weather, current and the next few days are critical to the effective performance of my business. Before the recent changes to the BOM website, I could clearly see the current rain radar and wind conditions allowing me to plan for the next few hours, the day ahead, or even the next week. The new website may have that information available, but not all in one place. I don't understand how an upgrade can be a retrograde step in providing information to a community that needs it. And Clonton from Cootamundra says, for pilots like me, our lives and those of our passengers depend on accurate and easily accessible weather forecasts and reports. The fundamental mistake made by BOM was to roll out the changes with no warning to users. Nate, it's a safety issue.
It is. And actually, there were a couple of things there. People probably ignored it, but for quite a bit of time, there was a banner on the top of the website saying that there was this new website that was going to be launched. It had the date. There was a beta version that you could click through to have a look at. So they had given some warning. I'm not necessarily suggesting that it was done the best way it could have been done, but there was some. And all of the information, almost all of the information is still there. Certainly the safety critical stuff. So aviation, yes, 100%. Weather is everything. And if you happen to be an aviator, you can still find all of those warnings, all the TAFs, the pilots know what I'm talking about. That's all still there. It's just where you have to click to get to it might have changed, but it is still there. The thing is, Tegan, the old website wasn't good. It was a pain in the bum to steer around and to find information. But once you did, and once you knew how to get that specific bit of information that you specifically needed, then it all of a sudden felt easy. But I mean, they've replaced an awful website with one that's not servicing the customers in the way that the customers are expecting, I think.
So much of how we interact with any website is about muscle memory. Laurie, you're in journalism and communication and the way we communicate weather. Do you think it's just about people's expectations when they log on?
It's probably not just about that. I think, it's true. It's a safety issue in a lot of contexts. But I think that it is also a cultural icon, the Bureau of Meteorology. A couple of years ago, when we were told, we can't call it the bomb, what struck me as odd about that request was that it's a real compliment. It's called the BOM. It's a major cultural institution. And I would argue one step further, it's a major media organisation in its own right. So actually, if the rest of the media, and please don't let this happen, but if the rest of the media disappeared overnight, all the material that we would need to understand what's going on in the weather would still be there. And I think in the latest Bureau of Meteorology annual report, I think they had got to a point, and I'm not entirely sure, but of the significance of these figures taken on their own. But over 80% of community people reported the Bureau's services are easy to use, and 92% of emergency management customers surveyed have a good perception of the Bureau. So even though the old site might have had its issues, in a way, it's also been something that people have, got used to using over time. And it may well be that it will take quite a while for people to make that adjustment to what's, whatever this new website is going to evolve into, because obviously they're still working on it. And, I take the Bureau at its word that they're going to respond to some of the concerns that have been made now.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with Professor of Journalism at La Trobe University, author of The Weather Obsession, Laurie Zion, and ABC meteorologist Nate Byrne, talking about why we're so obsessed with the weather, what role it plays in our lives, not just when we're outside, but also the things we talk about, the things that we care to know about. Kim in the Yarra Valley says, "My obsession started young. I come from a surfing, camping, skiing, and outdoor activity family. The bomb saved my family's lives in the 2009 Black Saturday bushfires. We were able to make a positive decision not to be in Marysville that day." And Rachel from Nam says, "I love the weather. How would I know when the perfect washing day is without the weather? It shapes our lives and it's the one common denominator with every single living thing in our area. How amazing." And she says, "It is in fact the perfect washing day today." Nate, you are an admin for a social media group called Weather Obsessed that's run by the ABC. More than 170,000 followers. How do you think social media has changed the way we talk about the weather?
Oh, it's brought weather from around the world to our doorsteps and means that we get a way to see how it's affecting people. And I'm talking specifically here severe weather, but then I guess also an amazing sunrise or, you know, a funny looking cloud in the sky or some weird phenomenon where the sun's causing a halo. Those are things that you don't necessarily get to see yourself every day, but they're often happening somewhere in the world. And social media means that those things don't have to be filtered through a time-limited media organization. You know, you can just show pretty things because you want to show pretty things, but then also you can get insights into the, yeah, the wild weather that's going on for someone. And we're always interested because if it can happen to someone else, it could happen to us as well, I think. You know, that's why we are drawn to things like the news and to, you know, in emergencies around the world, because we've got an interest to learn from them in case we have to face that same sort of thing one day.
And yeah, on extreme weather, the climate has changed in our lifetimes, and I think we're starting to see and remember that now. Do you think that that's impacted the kind of the stakes when we're talking about weather?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, we're setting records all the time, whether it's heat or rainfall or flooding or, you know, we're setting them at a faster rate than we should be, really. And yeah, the stakes are highest, the highest they've ever been. I mean, for more and more of us, things like summer, it's becoming a time to survive rather than to thrive and have a holiday and chill. You know, it's literally life and death, and becoming increasingly so as time progresses.
Mm. Laurie, I'm interested. One of the things that you've looked at in your research is the variations of who is interested in the weather depending on where they live. And I have noticed on the text line, at least, quite a few people saying that they're from Nam. Is that representing what you saw?
Yeah, I think the people in Nam, like me, I'm very aware of the four seasons in one day motif of Melbourne's weather. The research that's been done on all of this was actually done in the US, but the finding from that is people who have, you know, cold fronts followed by hot days, in other words, where the weather might be quite changeable, are much more likely or somewhat more likely to actually be really interested in what's happening on a daily basis. So that said, I do think if you're in Darwin, I went to Darwin as part of the research for this book, and it was just in the build-up period. So people were obsessed by the weather there because, firstly, 36 feels a lot hotter than 34 there when they had those days, but also the thunderstorms come in, when will the monsoon start, all those different things. So some people would probably be more episodically interested in the weather in a particular time of year. But where you've got a climate like what we have in Victoria, Tasmania, Canberra, it means that you really don't know. The weather you've got outside today, which is beautiful, maybe won't last, you know, more than today or even today. And in fact, there's a lot of rain in the forecast at the moment. So people need that information, I think, in order to make even, you know, what might be seen as non-consequential decisions like what to wear to work, whether to eat outside, do a picnic or whatever. But I wouldn't call these things trivial. I think it's very much part of our culture, the weather, and the information that weather services such as the Bureau provide, I think is really, is genuinely useful to people. And so in that context, I think when people feel that it's harder to reach that information or that there's been a big change, then definitely they're going to react to that. And so, yeah, so, but I do think that that interest in the weather also is reinforced a lot through media, because, you know, it's very hard to get weather systems to move around the country now without them becoming major stories, whether in national-focused media like news.com.au, The Guardian, or local papers as well. So the whole way weather's reported on has changed a lot, and people are engaging with that.
I can only speak from my own experience as a person on tank water and a street that floods. I'm always obsessively watching the number of mils that my rooftop is about to get rained upon it. Well, Laurie, Nate, thank you both so much for joining me. Laurie Zion is a professor of journalism at La Trobe University and the author of a book called The Weather Obsession. And Nate Byrne is, of course, meteorologist on ABC News Breakfast. If you turn on your TV in about 2 minutes, you'll probably see him pop up there again. He's a fast runner, and for that we are grateful. Thank you also for your texts. Helen says, my mood is very much governed by the weather. A windy day does my head in. I'm a weather forecaster tragic. And Chris says, I wish that as a society we would stop seeing rain as bad weather. I understand the implications for farmers and people working the land, but rain and storms can be very beautiful. Well, up next, we're staying in the natural environment, talking about nature but with luxury conveniences. Should we let private enterprise into our national parks?
Tasmanian salmon. It's on dinner plates across Australia. And it's a billion-dollar business with jobs for Tassie. But it's a lightning rod for locals too, concerned about its environmental impact. Radio National's next citizen jury comes from the Huon Valley, where citizens share their solutions. Join me, Natasha Mitchell, for Citizen Jury on Big Ideas, Wednesday 8 p.m, Thursday midday on ABC Radio National.
For a lot of people, a trip to a national park involves loading up the car, then setting up a tent, grabbing drinks out of the cooler, hoping you've remembered to pack the batteries for your torch. But increasingly, a national park experience can look very different. Luxury lodges, glamping, catered dining, maybe at the end of the day, a relaxing Shiraz in an actual glass. It's nature with luxury conveniences. And it's part of a growing trend that's seen national parks around the country used for permanent, private, plush accommodation. This week, the news broke that New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service has called for expressions of interest from businesses to provide supported camping in 16 national parks and reserves across the state. Details are still pretty scant, but the government says it'll be a service that provides fully set up camping sites for locals and travellers from interstate and overseas. The parks include our most iconic, like Kosciuszko and the Blue Mountains. So, is this a valuable source of revenue? Does it make our national parks more accessible? Or is this just privatising public space? And here to chat about it with me is Jessie Burke, the president of Bushwalking New South Wales, and Sonia Underdahl, who is a professor of environmental sociology at Itagawa University in Japan. Jessie, I might start with you. How did you hear about this latest plan?
Hi, Tegan. So we heard about this after one of our members happened to have a keen eye and came across the proposal. It wasn't made public, so it was just by luck that we came across it.
So it wasn't very well advertised, is that sort of what you're saying there?
No, it wasn't advertised at all.
Do you have concerns about this proposal or this call for expressions of interest?
Yeah, we do have concerns about it, particularly because it wasn't publicised. So as bushwalkers and members of Bushwalking New South Wales, we are frequent users of these parks. Bushwalking clubs and individual walkers rely on fair and affordable access. So this proposal would, take that away from us.
So the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service behind this. We reached out to them. A spokesperson said in part that by offering a service that provides fully set up camping gear, camping can be made more accessible, encourage more people to explore the outdoors and help them gain confidence, and that it'll be operating side by side with existing campsites that will remain open to the public, no exclusive use of any campsite by a private operator. Jesse, as a bushwalking club, you're sort of with a group of people who are quite confident. Do you think that there's an argument here that this actually does make the national parks more accessible?
So the proposal suggests that private operators will have 12 month able to book out these campsites 12 months in advance. So they'll be able to book it out and make it, you know, less available to bushwalkers. Services for first-time campers already exist, and we don't need to hand exclusive access to private companies to help people experience the outdoors.
Sonia, you've researched tourism inside public protected areas. What do you make of this accessibility argument?
So this is thank you for having me. Basically, this is a very, very current topic we've been covering throughout Australia, with protests and legal actions taken, both at the Supreme Court level, federal court level, and we've been protesting in communities throughout Queensland, New South Wales, and also Tasmania. It's extremely controversial because it's basically allowing private developers to benefit from our public areas, locking us out. And there are claims that we're getting economic benefit. We're also getting jobs, and we're also doing this to protect or to conserve the environment. And my research shows very clearly that that is absolutely not the case on any of those levels.
Can you tell me more about the research you've done and what you found?
Sure. We've held multiple surveys throughout a lot of these communities, including Beoa National Park down in New South Wales. And we've been looking at what the public thinks and what they feel. I've also done a series of interviews and research with tourism operators that are working and functioning in the areas already prior to these contracts being delivered to one certain tour operator or one proponent. And my research shows that the systems that we're talking about here, where someone gets a contract, they can go in and they can set up their private equipment and allow access for their clients, actually only caters to 0.0.
Sonia, have we still got you there?
It's a population that utilises national parks.
Sorry, Sonia. I think your phone line just cut out a little bit before. But what I wanted to put to you was this part of the statement that I mentioned before from New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service. The spokesperson said that supported camping will be side by side existing campsites. All the campgrounds will remain open to the public. They're not exclusive use.
Yes.
Isn't it unfair to say the public will have less access to national parks?
That is in some cases. In the other cases, which are already established throughout Australia and are still continuing, we actually have some which now have private use and private guests only signs up. So it's not to say that that is the actual example throughout. In this case, yes. And in this case, they're saying that they're opening up next to public, which is also a case they've done at Hinchinbrook and Whitsunday Islands, etc. But tourism operators find that this is a monopolistic or unfair trade practice. They're unable to financially be supported. They're unable to get enough revenue in order to support their businesses. They're also unable to compete with a proponent that has access or unfair access to our World Heritage areas, our national parks, for their exclusive product, and generally at very, very low cost for rents. For example, Spices, they pay $10,000 plus GST a year rent for two massive resorts inside our World Heritage and National Park areas. So we're not really getting economic benefit out of it, and we're also reducing the ability for tourism operators to compete.
So in Australia, this is something that both Labor and Liberal state governments have pursued. It's not a really a partisan thing. Sonia, what's behind the trend of privatising recreation and conservation lands?
So it seems that these developers are quite powerful. They're some of the biggest organisations in the world. They're actually lobbying through, and I've done some research and published on this in regards to trying to lobby the UN itself to allow access to develop their resorts and facilities in national parks globally. So we're not talking about small companies or small businesses. Spice is owned by Flight Centre, for example. We've got Australian Walking Company. We've got Tasmanian Walking Company. We've got Experience Co., Intrepid. These are all massive organisations, Salter Brothers, multi-billion dollars organisations. So there is obviously big business behind it and lobbying and trying to sell it to us as if it's a really nice idea to allow a monopolistic takeover of public facilities.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, speaking with Professor Sonia Underdahl, who's an environmental sociology researcher, and Jesse Burke, who's the president of Bushwalking New South Wales, about expressions of interest now being open for private operators to provide supported camping in New South Wales national parks. Nothing's happened yet, but it really does seem like the door is opening towards that. One text says, we need to talk about how we use national parks and balance enjoying it with the impact of people. More tourists is spoken about as a good thing, and we treat nature as a commodity to be exploited. Ken in Fingal Head says, many of the national parks in Africa include glamping, and it provides a much needed source of revenue to manage the parks and is a big plus for preserving the environment and wildlife. Carnarvon Gorge in Queensland, one person says, has permanent glamping as well as casual camping and a restaurant. It does allow all ages to join a beautiful park. I can hear you thinking through as I read those texts out, Sonia. What are your comments to those perspectives?
Thank you. Carnarvon Gorge is actually a historical lease that's transferred over. So they managed to retain the business section of that. So it's a little bit of an anomaly. In regards to private operators, just to be clear, private operators have always been able to access national parks. But historically, we do tourism which is adjacent to the national parks. So we will stay in accommodation in regional Airbnbs, use the cafes, the restaurants, use the facilities, shops of those regional communities, and they really do benefit from it. They've had COVID, drought, bushfires. They have had massive amounts of problems in regards to finding employment and getting that economic benefit. And so putting people in an adjacent location and then transferring them through to the national park where they can do the walk and at the end of the day return to their facilities and accommodation really benefits the local community and provides regional jobs. My research shows that when you're located inside the park, you're picked up from a hotel or the airport, you then take them out on track, they stay on track inside facilities with the tour guides doing the driving, the cooking, the cleaning, all of that, and then they're returned back to an airport. So the regional area is really not benefiting from the facilities being located within parks. The other thing you have to look at is our ability to compete as tourism operators against somebody who is supported by the state and federal government and local councils. For example, if we're having a look at the Signature Experiences of Australia, the marketing alone by the federal government under Tourism Australia, it's a $202.3 million tourism industry. And they partner with airlines, STOs, distribution partners. They provided in 1 year 12,877 PR event contents, 630 media and broadcast clips. They're focusing and targeting 17.3 million visitors. So when you're becoming an operator within the national parks, you also streamline into the marketing, the advertising, and you're getting the government support through their booking systems, advertising on national park websites, events, webinars, workshops. They're targeting 78,000 frontline travel sellers internationally. This is something that a regular tourism operator is unable to compete with. And my research shows that the local tour operators are now heading overseas where they can find a free trade market. So, they're listing it now as Australia being a monopoly, and they're unable to financially compete.
So, Jesse, after you learnt about this supported camping plan, you contacted all of the local Bushwalking New South Wales clubs. What kind of action have they taken?
Yeah, so there's been strong opposition across our clubs. We represent 70 clubs across New South Wales and ACT, which is made up of about 12,000 members. So within 48 hours of being notified of the proposal, clubs had sent letters to the minister and their local member for parliament. So bushwalkers and the general public are stakeholders for national parks. It's a public asset. So we believe that regardless of your stance, national parks should have consulted with the public, including Bushwalking New South Wales. The bushwalking movement was instrumental in the establishment of many of our well-known parks, including Blue Mountains National Park. And we have an ongoing and collaborative relationship with national parks. The expression of interest actually closed this week, but the decision or the outcome of that won't be reached until early February. So our suggested solution is that the New South Wales government withdraw or substantially revise the proposal. Any changes to campground management or access should occur only after genuine public consultation and with a clear demonstration of public benefit. We ask that the New South Wales government reaffirm its commitment to maintaining national parks as spaces for recreation, connection to nature and community wellbeing rather than as commercial venues.
So, Sonia, some of this is baked into what Jesse's just said, but if there's concerns about this, but these sorts of offerings are popular. Lots of people do them and enjoy them. So if they do end up being part of the national parks offering, how do we do them well?
Thank you. That's a great question. Yes, the glamping model is extremely popular. But how do we do it well? We basically have to ensure a free and fair trade opportunity for all operators to access those sites. And you have to remember with operators, they require a certain amount of visitors or guests in order to make a profit and to be financially sustainable. So, for instance, if you have 40 spaces, 40, and we require 15 spaces for a company to make a profit, so we need 15 guests that are allowed on board, it means only two companies can access those spaces if there are 40 available for profit. But what's happening is a lot of the companies are actually booking out in advance. They're taking the entire bunch, and that locks out all other operators. So there really needs to be a fair bidding system if that's going to be the case. And being aware that there are minimum numbers that have to be met to make a profit, usually around 15 from my research. And so that basically either allows one operator or maybe two, but there has to be a system which ensures that everyone has an opportunity to be financially viable. The other issue is, of course, that with tourism operators, they are taking spaces that could be allocated to independent walkers who are already booked out. Operators getting 1 year in advance for making their bookings, whereas independents get 6 months. So there are some issues there in regards to community. And my surveys and research showing that community is asking for more spaces, more access to parks for independent camping, and less spaces for tourism or no space, because they are obviously taking up for massive profits, personal private profits, spaces that could be for regular families and independent campers.
On the text line, one person says, national parks are first to protect the natural elements of the area, then to facilitate people to view or experience those things into the long future. The best way to do this is to place all developments on the edge of or near the park, then develop access to those areas that can handle it. Well, I will just reiterate a little bit more of the New South Wales Parks statement that they provided to us. They said having a variety of businesses operating within national parks is not new. It's been occurring since 2009. Private businesses already offer guided tours and equipment hire, which sometimes includes supported camping. There are currently 383 licensed operators. They book less than 1% of overnight stays, and most of them are for school children participating in outdoor education programs. The full statement from the Park Service will be available online with this segment, but thank you very much to Jessie and Sonia Jessie-Burke, the President of Bushwalking New South Wales, and Sonia Underdahl, Professor of Environmental Sociology at Itagawa University in Japan. Up next, TV icon Suzanne Summers. I don't know if you remember her. She died in 2023, but now she's back as an AI clone.
As each day begins,
get the facts you need to stay informed.
Every day, across your day, you can stay in the know with ABC News.
To fuel your daily conversations, follow the discussion to stay connected.
From your neighbourhood, across the country,
and around the world.
Stay with Australia's trusted news source.
All the latest, all verified.
Stay in the know with ABC News.
Go to news.abc.net.au or download the ABC News app.
Suzanne Summers was one of the biggest TV stars of the 1980s and 1990s. She was on sitcoms like Three's Company and Step by Step. She also made a name for herself marketing the iconic fitness gadget, the Thighmaster. Well, sadly, Suzanne died of cancer in 2023, but now her husband of 46 years has brought her back, kind of. Alan Hamill has created an AI clone of her, saying that when he sees the two of them side by side, he can't tell which is real and which is AI. And his next plans are to upload her to be a 24/7 AI chatbot for her fans. I really want to unpack the ethical implications of creating an AI bot for a loved one. Patrick Stokes is an associate professor of philosophy at Deakin University. He's back for our regular segment called Ask Aristotle. Pat, I can't imagine Aristotle even being able to fathom this conversation that we're about to have.
Well, no, but he did have some views on the dead and whether the dead can be harmed or benefited and things like that. So even some of these seemingly really modern problems, and they are very kind of, you know, contemporary sort of problems, they have kind of antecedents that go right back into the philosophical canon.
Oh my gosh, that's so interesting. Well, I want to get to that, but first, when you first heard about this AI Suzanne Summers, what was your, like, visceral reaction at first?
Yeah, well, I have to admit, this is actually a topic that I've been working on for about 15 years, for quite a while now.
Suzanne Summers AI.
Not Suzanne Summers specifically, no. It's not Thighmaster studies, but no, I've been interested in, for a very long time, in digital death and the way in which we use what people call our digital remains, the things that we leave behind when we die and how we remediate those, how we like use them in AI and in memorials and things like that. I've been working on that topic for, yeah, quite a long time now, as have a great many other people, I should say. And just in the last 12, 18 months, suddenly everyone wants to talk about this. So it's been a good time for people working on the topic of digital death. And I'm currently doing a 3-year ARC-funded project called Digital Death and Immortality here at Deakin Uni. And so this is one that sort of came up, and me and the other people on the team were like, oh, hey, did you see that thing about Suzanne Summers? And it's interesting in the sense that on the one hand, this is something a lot of people are doing. A lot of very ordinary people are doing this as well. They're setting up AI bots of loved ones as part of their grieving process. We've been talking about this as a looming technology, as I say, for nearly 15 years. And then probably about 18 months ago, people went, oh, hang on, they're already doing it commercially at scale in China. Yeah. So this is already happening. This is already a thing. It's looming. loomed. The problem has loomed. And so the Susan Summers one is not that new in that sense, but the fact that it's Susan Summers, the fact that it's high profile, and the fact that her husband, Alan Hamill, has got these really big plans for this bot are really quite fascinating, some of which look really speculative, but it is a really interesting example.
When I first heard this idea of anyone being a 24/7 chatbot, I was just like, oh, can't that poor woman just have a break now? Like, obviously it's not her, I know that, but this idea of resting in peace feels really hard if anyone, any huge number of people could be theoretically talking to you at any time of the day forever.
Yeah, this is actually a huge problem. There's a worry that chatbots in general and death bots in particular, we call them death bots. In our project, we call them IPCDs, interactive personality constructs of the dead, but that doesn't
exactly... Death bots, snappier for sure.
Let's go with death bots for the moment. There's a worry that because they're always on, because they're always available, and that's true of AI in general, there's a worry that that will actually distort our sense of what we can expect from people. That will actually, like, you know, real flesh and blood people who aren't always there, who seem to sleep sometimes and sometimes don't answer your messages immediately or leave you on bread or whatever, may not be as satisfying to us as AI. And there's a real kind of worry there that'll either change our etiquette or it will make us just generally disappointed in real people and start to prefer AI. But there's also just this general question too of, should Susan Summers have to keep doing this? Should she have to keep working, you know, after she's died? That sounds silly in a way. But it's a legit question. One of the things her husband's floated is he said, well, now I've got an AI of Susan Summers. Why can't we get the estate of John Ritter to make an AI of the actor John Ritter, who died of a heart attack on the set of 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter some years ago, and put them both in to do some new episodes of Three's Company, the show they were doing in the late 70s, early 80s. And it's like, yeah, or we could let these people not do that. And like, not actually kind of exploit the dead to do new episodes of things. There are, at the very least, there are some serious questions about the propriety of doing that.
Okay. So this is what you were talking about before. You were like, Aristotle even thought about whether it's possible to harm the dead. If honestly, like, it feels crass to talk about it, and with all respect to these people who have loved and have gone, but what difference does it really make to monetize their likeness if they're not here anymore?
Well, this is an interesting thing. I find people kind of split into two camps. So some people are with that sort of Aristotle view, according to which Aristotle said it would be heartless to claim that the dead are not harmed or benefited by things like the fortunes of their descendants, for instance. And a lot of us have those intuitions that, for instance, if you find out somebody was wrongly hanged for a crime they didn't commit 100 years ago, there's a sense in which exonerating them is the right thing to do for them. Not just for everyone else who's alive now, but also for them. It's a good thing to do for them, to restore their name. Equally, if you slander someone who's dead, it seems like you're harming them. When they're alive, they had an interest in having a good reputation, and you're harming that reputation. So some people fall into that camp. Other people side with one of Aristotle's students, Epicurus, and say, yeah, you know what? If you can't experience it, it doesn't matter. Mm. Right. So if you can't, if the dead can't experience things like being slandered or being praised, then you're not actually harming or benefiting them. So it doesn't really matter. So if you want to use a chatbot of someone who's long dead and exploit their image in that way, who cares? I'm kind of more in the former camp, but I kind of also get where people are coming from who are in that Epicurean side as well.
And so I suppose one of the things that lies behind this is that someone who lived 100 years ago would not have even known how to say that their wishes were like, please don't make an AI chatbot of me.
Yeah.
But these days we do have that. And that's actually something that some of your colleagues have looked at.
Yeah. So there's this interesting question about whether or not you can have how much autonomy you can have over this process. For some people, you know, before they die, they might say, yeah, go ahead and clone me after I die, set up an AI chatbot based on me, that's fine. Or even you can do it now before I die. And with Susan Summers, that seems to have been the case, actually, that they talked about it before she died. Apparently, she and her husband were friends with Ray Kurzweil, the futurist, and they'd talked about this years ago. So this is something she was apparently kind of on board with. Other people have done that. William Shatner's done a similar thing. So you can go down that path. On the other hand, there's this question of after somebody's died, is it okay to do it? And to a certain extent, it comes down to a kind of relationship of stewardship. You know, in a way, we have a kind of responsibility to steward the dead who are kind of handed over into our care. Like, so, and that can be as simple as organising someone's funeral, right? Deciding how that funeral is going to be. It's a kind of stewardship. And in that sense, you can say you're making a decision on behalf of the person whether or not it's okay to make a chatbot out of them. Interesting question about whether anyone should have the authority to do that. And if so, who has the authority? What happens if people within a family disagree? And this is some of the stuff we're trying to work on in this project, is coming up with some sort of ethical frameworks to put around this stuff. But there's also an interesting question of whether people should have the right to say preemptively before they die, no, when I die, delete my stuff, do not reanimate me. Deborah Bassett, who's a researcher who works on this stuff in the UK, has slightly cheekily called these digital do not resuscitate orders. So just as you can get an order when you go into hospital saying, if my heart stops, don't resuscitate me, just let me go. There's an interesting question of whether people should be able to say, if I die, I don't want any AI recreations of me after I die, and exerting authority that way. And one of the problems here is just that the law is way behind the technology here in most jurisdictions. At best, there's some protection for celebrities. New York State, for instance, if you're a celebrity and you die, because your image has monetary value, you can actually, or your estate does have an automatic right to control how that image is used. Now, that's only just come in, including AI uses. But for ordinary people, there's really no kind of protection beyond just intellectual property law. And it's a real problem that we don't have protections of people against this stuff.
So that's like my choice about my, you know, digital image. But then we also have seen recently, just staying with the celebrity theme, Robin Williams's daughter Zelda has asked fans to stop sending her AI-generated videos of her dad. It can disrupt people's grieving process.
Yeah, there's an interesting question around whether these technologies, which are sometimes presented to us as technologies for helping with grief, and particularly now that prolonged grief disorder, so grief that goes on too long or is too kind of disruptive, is actually recognised as a medical condition, according to the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual 5. Because of that, there's a suggestion that these technologies can be used to help people with their grief, to help them learn to move on or to renegotiate their relationship with a dead person, which, when you think about it, is kind of what grieving is. There's a very provocative paper from 2022 from a Swedish grad student named Laura Lindemann, then grad student, in which she said, oh, okay, well, she's kind of calling people's bluff on this and saying, if you think these are techniques or technologies for dealing with extended grief, then we're talking about medical technologies and they should be regulated as such. So if you want to use a death bot, you need to get a prescription from a psychiatrist, because otherwise, you know, we just don't let people use medical technologies or therapeutic technologies without regulation, which I think is a really interesting point. If that's what they're meant to be, then they need to be regulated.
So Pat, would you sign a digital DNR? Or can we talk to you on Life Matters in perpetuity if you ever do shuffle off?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in two minds about it. On the one hand, I don't think anyone would bother setting up a bot to, unless it was to yell at me. But on the other hand, I'm kind of like, you know, there are going to be uses of the technology that I can't imagine right now. And saying no preemptively to things that you can't imagine might actually be more problematic than just leaving it open-ended and leaving it to the goodwill of your stewards.
Another ethical minefield we'll have to leave for another day. Pat, as always, thanks for chatting with me.
Thanks, Tegan.
Patrick Stokes is an Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly. We call our chats Ask Aristotle. He low-key hates the name, but I'm not changing it. Thank you for your text. Joy from Warrnambool says, a deceased loved one chatbot would mess with my head and grieving process. I feel I would remain in a suspended state, unable to mourn their physical loss. We talked earlier about the weather, and one person has texted in saying, I used to work on managing very large and sometimes noisy events, which were required to have noise monitoring. We rarely had any problems, but one New Year's Day, we were overwhelmed with complaints from as far away as 7 kilometres as the crow flies, despite complying with regulations. We couldn't figure out what was going on till I asked a fellow public servant at the bomb if there was any weird weather conditions. There had been a temperature inversion in Sydney that day, causing a border of hot and cold air that the music was sliding along for kilometres. This person signs off, Love the bomb. We also spoke before about national parks and whether private operators should be allowed to offer services within the national parks. Robbie says getting away from it all should be just that, away from all the hooks and favours of the city. Another says national parks do not exist for our fun. Conservation should be the first consideration, with resorts being outside the park. Janet says we have camped in Australia's national parks for most of our camping lives. Keep private operators out. The less private intervention, the better. We've actually stopped using national parks because of the difficult online booking system introduced. Most unsatisfactory. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow, Beverly Wang will be back with you, as is tradition on a Friday, talking about the fact that the most unhelpful thing you can say to someone when they're concerned is, don't worry about it. She'll be taking your calls on the role that worrying has played in your life, when you've caught yourself worrying, and she'll be chatting to a psychotherapist with tools on how to overcome worry. How to stop worrying and start living. That's tomorrow with Beverly on Life Matters. I'll be back with you again on Monday. Until then, take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.